everyone. This is Kelly Carlin, host of the podcast Waking from the American Dream, and many other things, including the daughter of some guy named George Carlin. Anyway, I'm here talking to Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UMC Radio.
Oh, shalom. Good morning, everybody. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon. I am the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York, and I am thrilled to be talking to someone who, like me, is on the radio, who, like me, is a writer, and who, unlike me, is the daughter, well, I couldn't be a daughter of anybody, but she is the daughter of one of the greatest comedians ever in the history of comediania. He was George Carlin. She is Kelly Carlin. She's on Sirius XM. She is also doing her one-woman show at the All for One Festival at the Cherry Lane Theater this month. Don't miss it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Shalom Kelly Carlin.
Hello, everyone.
Wow, that was a very delayed response there. I thought I shocked you.
I was expecting applause or something with that fantastic introduction. It sounded like there should be like 10,000 people out there applauding.
10,000? I can't even get a minion for my synagogue. I can't find 10 people, let alone 10,000. But still, I'm clapping in my head, okay? So envision that. envision me having the clap. And you will understand. Wait, that didn't come out right.
That's disturbing. No, that didn't.
Isn't it? Yeah. Anywho, welcome to the show. So Kelly, where do we even go? What made you put together a one-person show, you being the person, about your life and being the daughter of George Carlin?
Well, the last 12 years, I had been writing and performing autobiographical essays around Los Angeles mostly. I'd also in 2000 done a very short run of a one-woman show about my life and also about my mother who had died a few years earlier before that, and
sorry,
didn't do a full run of it or anything, and it had a different approach, different themes and angle to it. So how this all started, though, is I wasn't planning on doing this, but in the fall of 2010, 3 years ago, Louis Black, the comedian who...
Oh, I love him, and he's Jewish, yes.
And, yes, he is Jewish, and he was a friend of my dad's, and very much my dad had personally supported his career early on by giving him encouragement, and so I met Louis at my father's memorial, and we became friends. So 3 years ago, Louis invited myself and my husband to go on something called Lou's Cruise, which was basically a Bacchalian cruise to the Caribbean with 7 comedians, 400 Louis Black fans, and a very large Swedish boat. And
the images in my head already, they're just, I'm going to need a shower. You continue?
You might. I think I needed a liver transplant after the cruise, but... anyway, he said, I want you guys to come on board, but I need a day event, so why don't you come on and... He says, I don't know, just show some videos of your dad and tell some stories. You know, you've got great family stories. So that's what I did. I went on and didn't really plan it at all. Pretty much just did it off the top of my head, played a video, told a story, played a video, told a story. Well, the 400 fans and everyone just laughed and cried their way through the whole thing and were blown away and said, you know, you really have something here. And I thought, oh, yoy, what do I want to do? Do I want to do this? No, I don't know.
You do a pretty good oy for a shiksa. I will give you that.
Well, you know, I did grow up in West Los Angeles in the business, so that's all I'm saying.
So you're not Jewish, but you're circumcised in a manner of speaking. Yes.
Exactly.
So what is an example, Kelly Carlin, of a wonderful family story? Like one of those that you told that first time and maybe still tell in your show, A Carlin Home Companion.
Well, one of the more famous stories that I tell is a story that my father told in his memoir, but he told it from his perspective. I told it from my 9-year-old perspective, which is one morning my dad came into my bedroom and woke me up in a bit of a panic to tell me that he was very concerned because he thought that maybe the sun had exploded and we only had about 8 minutes to live. And so I stared at him for a second, thinking, oh dear, I think he's completely lost his mind, or he's just been doing way too many drugs lately. But then I thought, you know what? He's my dad, and he's generally a pretty rational man, so I think we better go outside and check. And so our family did. We went outside and checked, and the sun was very, very bright, and Dad decided that, you know, we need to check and make sure if I'm right about this. And so he pondered that he could call his friend Doc on the East Coast, but that there's this three-hour time difference, and would the sun, the phenomenon of the sun exploding, be the same on the East Coast? And then he decides to call his friend in Sacramento, and he calls his friend, and I just remember sitting there on the edge of his bed while he's on the phone with his friend from Sacramento, explaining to him that he needs him to go outside and check and see if the sun has exploded there. And, you know, it was all perfectly normal and rational. Of course, I knew that this was crazy. And
okay. I mean, you were 9, and this would have been not to give everybody your age, but I want to place this in the time zone of how old Carlin was at that time.
This was 1972, so...
Toledo window box, okay.
A clown, yeah. MAM, occupation fool, we were living on a big house in the beautiful Palisades, and yeah, you know, there was a lot of success and counterculture and all of the accoutrements that go with that.
So had he taken an hallucinogen before...
I think he probably had just been up for too many days on a stimulant of some kind, and... So I think he was just losing his mind a little bit.
Oh, well, there you go.
It was bright. I mean, I do have to say, it was kind of bright and really glary out that day. And, I mean, it did look a little weird, so I kind of understand.
It's a reflection of smog. That's all it, for goodness sakes.
I know. Pretty much.
But here's the thing. When you have a father who you knew, even like perhaps then, that he had issues with stimulants and things he was taking into his body, how could he ever sit you down and give you the talk that says, don't do drugs?
Well, he didn't. That's how he couldn't. That talk never came about. That talk was always about... I mean, my mother is someone who did she had a crazy drinking problem, and she ended up getting sober when I was 12, and so there was sobriety in the household, and my dad ended up, you know, doing a lot less drugs during my teen years, too. But no, neither one of them could really had a leg to stand on with that, and so it was always about moderation and safety and you know, make sure you're not in a car and you're not going to crazy places and hanging out with dangerous people, and, you know, so I did a lot of, you know, smoking pot at home and stuff like that.
Oh, there you go. It's better to be done in front of your parents than out where they don't know where you are. All right.
Okay. That was kind of the logic that the household was, you know, used to. Absolutely. I call it the homespun Carlin logic.
Well, think about it. Because other people, they may have looked at the parents and gone completely sober and straight edge. Other people would have looked at what they were doing and just had that addictive personality. Were you somewhere in between, or did you ever have to battle drugs, booze, stimulants, sex, whatever?
Yeah, no, I definitely have an addictive type of personality. My life got a little bit in my shambles in my 20s, and I had some issues with cocaine and a bad first marriage with a crazy guy. But, you know, I also, because I was the only child and for many years the adult in the household, I did have this part of my brain that very much knew that there were limits and that, you know, at some point, someone, you have to get on with it and grow up and all that kind of stuff. So I was lucky in that sense. I had this wise voice inside of me, while at the same time I had this voice that, you know, felt out of control at times. But I was much, much luckier than many of the people that I grew up with in this town, with, you know, parents who were rich, famous, and liberal and all of that. And some of them didn't make it, you know, and some of them are still struggling with stuff, and it breaks my heart. But
since this is radio, can you name some names, especially the dead ones? The living ones, maybe you don't want to, they're still friends, so you want to protect them. But the dead ones, you know, there's nothing they can really do.
No, I don't think I'd feel comfortable doing that. But you know, there are people out there who... are still, you know, still battling this stuff, and, you know, my heart goes out to them.
Well, you pulled yourself up, as it were, by your own bootstraps, or are you in 12, well, you wouldn't be in 12 steps if you're going on the Lewis Black booze cruise, but
I know. I was in Al-Anon for a few years. My mom did AA for a lot of years. I have a lot of access to that. I mean, I had a lot of access to that world and know it well. I have a pretty deep spiritual life. I'm a practicing Zen Buddhist, and I don't call myself an ism. I'm not a Buddhist or anything, but I have a lot of practices that keep me grounded now, and I've done a lot of therapy. I got master's in psychology, and, you know, so I understand the realm pretty well and very well, and, you know, and understand the psychology and the spirituality of it all.
Can you explain to me, you have been a life coach. That's one of the things you've done as a career. What's the difference between a life coach and a psychologist or psychiatrist? What is it?
Yeah, a psychologist or people who deal with psychology tend to focus more on, you know, use and look at someone's past, their childhood, in a way, and take them through deep emotional period, you know, processes that can help them release some of that or look at it in a certain way. And it tends to be more about, you know, what's going on in your psychology rather than your day-to-day, you know, it's more of a low-functioning thing when you go to a psychologist. A coach, someone who's a coach, certainly understands aspects of that, and I'm lucky. I have my master's in psychology, so I understand a lot of that aspect, so I can work deep with my clients. But really, life coaching and coaching in general is focused on who you are today and where you want to get to. And yes, your training, your childhood training.
I'm Rabbi Saul Solomon. I need to get to the bathroom. I know exactly where I'm going, yes?
Exactly.
Not always easy for me to get there in time, but still.
Right.
Yes, continue.
Maybe you have some childhood issues about a fear of the bathroom or something.
So of course.
In your background, that we would just say, well, that's one way of thinking of it, and that's the way you've been kind of thinking about it your whole life, but what would it be like if you thought about it this way? And then it's you know, there's some cognitive behavioral stuff, there's... but it's much more about goal setting and creating structure in your life in order to do and be the person that, you know, you want to grow into. It's not so much about anxiety and depression or, you know, it's not psychological, actual mental health issues you're dealing with. You're dealing with more of, you know, what are the things you really want to commit to and what's keeping you from doing it.
And you have applied these things, I assume, to your own life and career.
Absolutely, 100%.
So are you still doing life coach work, or now is all your work based in entertainment, the stage show, the radio, the blog, what?
You know, my podcast that I do, Waking from the American Dream, I talk a lot about my own creative process, about the journey of being a person. It's very much a kind of a spiritual-oriented show. I do speaking as an inspirational speaker. I do work one-on-one with some people. It's not something I'm doing this month in particular, but I do have that as something in my life. I'm very much passionate about people finding their passion, finding their bliss, following their creative urges. I've been someone lucky enough to be able to do that in my life, but I'm also someone who, for a few decades in my life, didn't know how to do that and was very stuck and had silenced my own voice. So I really understand both sides of that now, and I get a lot of joy in inspiring other people, motivating them, and helping them to connect to what they want to manifest, what they want to express.
That's
what I feel like is my life purpose, and so I do that through all of my other work. I mean, I feel my solo show it really is about that. It's about both my father and myself finding our true voices.
Well, this interests me, and I'm sure you've been asked this 400 zillion times, but the sense of being the daughter of a very famous and very great stand-up comedian, did that hinder your own creativity if you wanted to write something funny or go up in front of an audience for a while? Did you ever figure, I'll never be able to match Dad?
Yes, 100%, yes. In my mind, the perfectionism level was so intense inside of my head that it felt to me that even if I did a little something and stretched out of my comfort zone and maybe, you know, took a class or wrote a something or or, you know, I never did stand-up, but, you know, attempted something, it always felt in the end kind of empty because 10,000 people weren't cheering, you know, for me in an auditorium. And so that kind of high bar, it was very stifling for me and really crushed me in many ways until I really could find my own way through that. It's, you know, and some people who grew up in that situation don't have that. They're able to find their way, and, you know, their parents are their parents over there, and then they're over there, and they're separate and all of that. But that wasn't my struggle. My struggle was really about autonomy, finding my own sense of self, and it's something I struggle with even today. I mean, even doing this show, and, you know, every month, another month goes by, I find more and more an ease within myself, an understanding of what this show is really about for me.
Well, what is, if you were to put it in a sentence, you loved your dad, you are comfortable with him, and you are now comfortable in your own voice as a writer and to an extent a performer, so what is the show really about for you?
The show is really about, there's a couple of different things, one of which is growing up as an adult child of an alcoholic in that kind of dysfunctional family, which, you know, a good 99% of us grew up in some form of dysfunction. Except for you, of course. But there's a sense of invisibility and a muteness. There's a silence that comes with that role. And you have to pretend that everything's okay, and you don't get to tell the true story of your life as you're living it. And so on one page here, part of doing this show is just a real personal healing for me because I get to finally stand up and speak my story. And because I'm a Carlin and I got this crazy DNA and I like to be in front of people and I'm a communicator, I'd like to do it in front of a room full of perfect strangers. So that's the strangeness that I have. The other piece of this show is that, you know, my father grew up wanting to be someone like Danny Kaye, and I talk about it in the show, and that Danny Kaye was a big inspiration for him. And then my father's path and career and his own personal life and his artistic journey took him in a very different direction in some ways than Danny Kaye. And he became this voice of a generation. He became this truth speaker, and he became this man who, you know, brought the sledgehammer of truth to our culture. And he played this very different role. And so he had to let go. He was always shedding and evolving himself and letting go of who he just was in order to become the next version of himself. He was this blossoming figure in his artistic life decade after decade. And I feel very much like that is my path too. Even though it doesn't look like his and it wasn't done on a stage and on public and with my art at this point, but I, too, have had to figure out, what do I need to let go of? Who am I really? What's the truth of me now? And what do I need to step forward into this uncharted territory in order to claim really who I am? And so there's this parallel path between the two of us. And then on the third piece of this show is that when my dad died, his fans were so absolutely incredible to me. And the comedians in the comedy world have been so incredible. I didn't know any comedians before my dad died, and now I have a family of them, and his fans have come to me and shared their love of him and how much they miss him, and then they've gotten to know me through my work, my Twitter, you know, all of that, and they've, you know, become part of my family. My dad used to go around the country every 18 to 24 months and do his new thing. He'd have his next HBO show ready and lined up, or he'd be working on it or whatever, but he'd go to these towns and these cities, and people would wait around for 2 years for him to come around, and it really meant something to them. And in some ways, I wanted to give the gift of this show to them, and I too want to travel the country on a national tour and go to all the markets and all the cities and all the towns that he went to and give them a chance to, in some ways, say goodbye to him and get a fuller picture of him and see more of George Carlin and get to ride the ride of his life with me. So far, it's been an incredible, fulfilling experience. It's just been so wonderful. I feel so blessed and so great.
Well, which just means you haven't been to Secaucus, New Jersey yet.
Well, yeah.
At that point, it all goes downhill. And Peoria, other places, yeah. For now, you know, New York, sure. Yeah, New York is fine. But let me ask a couple of things. First of all, who is, are you the keeper of the Carlin Flame in the sense that who is making sure that his old CDs stay in print or on iTunes, that there's Carlin merchandise, or is that you, or who deals with
it? It's myself and my father's business partner for 30 years, Jerry Hamza, and he and I are the keepers of his legacy and protectors of it, and are the ones who decide what goes out and what doesn't and when and where.
And how much of that takes your time, and how much are you able to devote to your blog, your show, your other writing, what else you do?
Yeah, I don't spend a lot of time on my dad's stuff. I'm lucky I have Jerry as a partner. He manages the business side of it. I spend enough time on it to know that it's important and it keep it moving forward, but I don't, it's not like my life is dedicated to it. I really have, my life is about my work and spending time and hours creating my stuff and doing that, moving forward. But keeping the George Carlin legacy and that flame lit is very important to me, because I'm very proud of his work and proud of his legacy. I mean, the amazing thing that's happened in the last 5 years since he died is that, you know, the internet has exploded, and Twitter and Facebook, and he's on Netflix and he's on YouTube. And so I get notes from people all over the planet, Pakistan, Iran, Australia, India, Russia, who are discovering him for the first time and finding him and loving him and being inspired by his truth. And that is very, very exciting. And I know my dad would get a real kick out of that.
What's another story, another cool story you tell either in the show or in your older shows about growing up in the Carlin household?
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, my dad was busy. He was a road comic, so he was on the road a lot, and, you know, and that took a lot of toll on the family in general. But he was also a really, really dedicated dad. And, I mean, there's so many sweet little moments that, you know, I have some in the show. I'm hopefully going to work on a book in the future and put them in there. But, you know, I mean, he taught me to ride my two-wheel bike, you know. He always, like, there was always these teaching moments. I remember we moved down to Venice Beach here in L.A., and when we moved down, it was 1971. It was a very tough neighborhood, bikers and hippies and freaks and all of that. And my dad, I was 8 years old when we moved there, and I was just this little pumpkin of a kid. And my dad, the first week we were there, taught me how to walk down the street like a New Yorker so that no one would, you know, screw with me. Like, he taught me how to walk with the stare and with purpose. You know, when you're walking and someone, you feel a little hinky about something, you know, you put your walk on. And, he just darling little things like that. Another story I tell in the show is when I went on the road with him in 1972, my mom and I, in the summer, and we went to Kent State.
Oh, my God.
My dad took me to the memorial for where those college kids had been, you know, shot down by the National Guard. And he told me the story of what had happened. And he, you know, he really wanted me to understand as much as I could about what's going on in the world. And it was scary for me. I didn't really, you know, that kind of scared me a bit, that whole thing, because it's like, wait a minute, people in the government are shooting college kids? But
as well, they should sometimes.
You know, trying to let me know that, you know, there's people trying to speak the truth in the world, and there's always going to be people who's going to try to shut you down.
Now, if we follow the trajectory of your father's career on some level, I mean, he did the first years when he was on Ed Sullivan, and it was very fun material and light, and then he said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do more of a hippie and countercultural thing and change the world, as you say. And then he went into kind of the drug years, unfortunately, came out of that, did some more really amazing stuff, and then he sort of, it seemed to me in the 90s, he became angry, at least in his material a lot. It was a lot of anger on stage, still in a comic way. Was he that way home too?
No. His outrage on stage was a theatrical device to wake the world up. He knew by the 90s, after we had all gone through the 80s, and the world had become a different place, a harsher place, media had become harsher, just the world had become a harsher place, that he knew, he felt that in order to get through to the audience, he needed in some way to to shake things up. He called it the sledgehammer. So it really wasn't anger. It was more outrage and a real disappointment, a real broken heart about what was happening in the world. And I felt he was always on stage trying to say, you know, look what's happening, people. Don't you see this? You know, trying to shake them out of their distracted, you know, their easily distracted life, which is now even 10 times worse. So no, he wasn't an angry person at all. He had issues of rage, especially early on when he was, you know, a younger kid, and he had issues with authority figures, certainly, and his personality and all of that. But no, off stage, you talk to anyone who knew him or even encountered him briefly, he was known as one of the most kind, generous humans you will ever run into. But he had a lot of disdain for people in power who take advantage of people who have less power and who are oppressed by the system. He was a disappointed idealist.
Hey, who isn't? Who did your father admire as far as other comedians? Who did he idolize, look up to, or who did he find funny?
He was an easy laugh, which was great. Mm. But he had a lot of respect for Lewis Black. I didn't sit around talking comedy to him, but I mean, I remember growing up, Bob Newhart and Cosby, certainly Lenny Bruce was an inspiration to him on many different levels. He loved the smart, intelligent thing. He loved goofy humor, you know. I mean, that's part of who he was, too. He was very much a very silly comedian also. He had a lot of respect for a lot of people. He loved people who could tell great jokes. He loved Jackie Mason. Really loved Jackie. I mean, whenever Jackie was in town, he would go almost every single night to see Jackie.
Did you know that Jackie Mason was Jewish, by the way?
Yes, he was Jewish, by the way. Very Jewish, like as Jewish as you can get.
Yes, that was kind of a joke there. I guess my jokes need more work. We're talking with Kelly Carlin. She's doing her show, A Carlin Home Companion, on four different occasions in October. I'll tell you them right now. They're Friday, October 11th, Sunday, October 13th, Thursday, October 17th, Saturday, October 19th at the Cherry Lane Theater. They're all part of the All for One Festival there. And the Cherry Lane is right on Commerce Street in the heart of Greenwich Village. And by the way, when do you also do your blog, podcast, radio show?
I do my podcast almost weekly. I'm taking the month off because I've been prepping for this show and going to New York. But you can find it at iTunes. It's called Waking from the American Dream. I think I'm at my 95th episode,
Ooh.
Approaching 100.
And
I usually do it live on Thursdays, but all the archive shows are there. I do it live through Kevin Smith's network, which is called Smodcast. And then once a month, I have a show on Sirius XM on Raw Dog called The Kelly Carlin Show.
Oh, nice.
And I interview comedians. I do a one-hour in-depth interview with comedians. And I've had Robin Williams, Lewis Black, Kevin Pollak, Jeff Garlin. I mean, all sorts
of people. Okay, so share. So you've talked to all these wonderful people that I would love to talk to as well. What are some memories, things that you dug out of them that you didn't expect, funniest moments? Tell.
Oh, I don't know. I don't keep track of things like that. I think it's just fun because I have this degree in as a psychologist, and I'm a good listener. So the conversations I always end up having with these people are always different than what they expect. There's this kind of general interview that people have, and then I go in there and I really listen in the moment, and I do my homework and all of that, but I rarely even refer to it once we get going. And, you know, we usually have a good laugh, but things get deep. And I know with Jay Moore, every time I talk to Jay Moore, he and I end up talking about death and the afterlife, no matter what we're talking about. So that's always strange.
Okay.
I really enjoy, I think it's fun for them. They feel comfortable around me. They feel safe around me. They know I'm not going to, you know, because of who I am and how I grew up and my dad, that I'm not going to kind of take them in some sort of weird direction. So it's just a really great, great conversation, and I'm honored to have them. You know, it's fun. It's fun for me.
Well, having spoken now to a bunch of these comedians, can you make any, I won't say generic statements, but are there things that they all have in common that you've noticed? Is there a certain personality type thing that comedians have?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're all smart. They're all smart people. They all think all day long. They're thinking, they're observing, they're curious. They're the most curious people. They're asking questions. Why is this like this? What's going on? What does this mean? They know how to kind of think systemically and be the outsider and to look in at everything and kind of take this really big, broad point of view. And I think because of that, there's a loneliness in it too, you know. And I think they've been that lonely outsider their whole life. And I think humor is a way of bridging that loneliness, of connecting to people. You know, a room full of laughter makes you feel very connected. And when you can make a room full of people laugh, it makes you feel very connected. So I think they live on this interesting two sides of the same coin of connection and disconnection.
Really, really cool point. I connected with that, with Kelly Carlin here on Dave's Gone By. Just another couple of questions for you. First of all, you mentioned before that you had a crazy ex-husband. You went through all that. Now you have a not-so-crazy current husband that you write with. How does that work out? Is it easy to share with another person working together? Is it tough to be in the same business? What?
He is a director and a director of photography, and that's mostly what he does. But about 10 years ago, we did some writing together, and actually about 15 years ago. We haven't done it a lot lately, but he is great to write with because we both bring our own gifts and talent to the situation. We wrote some screenplays together and some TV show stuff, and he just has one gift of kind of the overall storyline and the plotting and what needs to happen next, and I'm always connecting to the emotional truth of the character through dialogue and stuff like that. So we bring these things together, and we work really, really well together and have a lot of fun with it. So,
and by the way, his name is...
anything in a long time, though.
His name is Robert McCall, and your full name is Kelly Carlin McCall, but for stage reasons, you go by Kelly Carlin.
Yeah, I go by Kelly Carlin. My legal name is Kelly Carlin McCall, yes. But yeah, my stage, my public name is Kelly Carlin.
Now, going back, of course, to a little bit more about your dad, the late, great George Carlin. What do you remember being the biggest disagreement that you ever had with him? I mean, you were a teenager still, you know, you grew up, you had your troubles. Was there ever a time when you weren't talking to him for 3 months or something like that?
No, not so much like that. I think the biggest disagreement we had was over time. He was always so busy, and I always wanted to spend more time with him, and he always had a great sense of that he didn't have enough time. And I don't know, part of that is just that he was very driven with his work, very, very, you know, just had just very focused on his work. And like most great artists are, I mean, that's why they're great and prolific, because they spend 90% of their psychic energy on their work. And also, I used to suspect, too, that just because, you know, he had this heart disease, he had his first heart attack in his 40s, and his dad had died young, and I think he felt also in some ways that he literally did not have enough time, and which for me was even more of a reason to want to spend time with him. But so there was always a friction about that, and I always felt like I was imposing myself on him, you know, in his times. I knew he was a busy man, but you know, the time we did spend together was just so wonderful. We'd always have such a great connection. So, I mean, I think that was the biggest tension in our lives. And then the other thing is, which I talk about in the show, which is a big kind of a turning point in the show, is that when I wrote my first one-woman show, I told stories about my childhood, and he was in it, and there were stories about his drug abuse in it. Nothing that he had not ever shared. I mean, he had shared all of this publicly, but it was hard for him. It was really difficult for him, and he just said to me, you know, I love you, and you can do whatever you want, but I can't come and sit in the audience. It's too painful for me. And that really broke my heart, because all I really wanted was for him to be proud of me, what I was doing, and, you know, see me on stage making people laugh, right, and think and all of that, just like he did. And that was just too hard for him. So that was difficult. That was a difficult time for us.
Can I ask, when was the last time you saw your dad? When, what were you doing that day? Were you just talking on the phone? Did you see him in person? You go somewhere?
Well, I'm going to leave that story for my solo show because it's the end of the show.
Oh, oops, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. But yeah, I saw him about a month before he died, and then I spoke with him on the phone for a few times during that month. So, and it was a very beautiful ending. It really was.
Well, if people want to hear that ending, they, of course, have to go to the Cherry Lane Theater to see A Carlin Home Companion with the delightful Kelly Carlin. Go to her website, kellycarlin.com, to find out about the show, also about how to hear both her podcast and her monthly SiriusXM show, all of that going on. My last question for you, and of course, thank you so much for being with us. Do you have a favorite George Carlin routine? Or bit, or even a part of a bit that he did.
Yeah, it's like picking your children, right? A favorite child.
Yeah, well.
There's so many great things. I mean, there's the two sides of it. The one side, like his most like political, amazing thing is a bit that he has called "The Planet Is Fine," which is from his 1992 HBO show. I can't remember the name of it right now. I'm spacing out. But that's like, I think that was like, that was groundbreaking. That's when he first started doing really strident material, and it's just, it's a brilliant beast of language and logic. And then, of course, on the goofy side of it all, my favorite routine is his segmented walking fart routine. Still, would makes me laugh. Could make me laugh 10 times a day, even if I had to watch it 10 times a day.
How better to end a memorial sort of for George Carlin than with walking farts, and with Kelly Carlin here on the phone with us. Kelly, I can only wish you much success with both remembering and bringing forth your father's work and birthing work of your own, which is also even as important. So thank you so much for being with us, for sharing with us, and best of luck with your show.
Thank you so much.
Shalom.